Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, today's date is Tuesday, March 6, 2012, and we do have quorum. First bill on our list is Senator DeKreif's Senate File 1689. Welcome to the committee, Senator DeKreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Senate File 1689 is a bill that basically talks about something called USERRA. It's the Uniformed Service Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. And it's a federal act, and what it basically does is if you are called up to service, it's a federal law that says that when you come back from service, you are guaranteed by your employer to your old job back. And what this bill actually does is it puts a state on that same playing field. Currently, the state is immune to prosecution from under this act. And what this does is this basically will say that if you're a service person that is employed by the state, and if you are called for active duty, if you're called to duty, and you come back, you will be allowed to get your job back, or you can bring civil suit against the state.
Senator DeKreif, do you have anyone else that wishes to speak on behalf of the bill?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
You do not?
I do not.
Right. Is there anyone who wishes to speak against the bill? Is there any discussion? It's going to be a short meeting. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No.
Was the bill moved?
Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't make a motion. Senator
Newman.
Bad day. Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1689 be recommended to pass and move to the Senate floor. No. Yes. Senate floor. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. Yes.
I'm sorry, but I'm reading through the bill, and there are a couple of other provisions in here that the author didn't mention. I don't know if maybe they're not related to the judiciary's jurisdiction, but can I get some idea? Are we supposed to be paying attention? Veterans, disabled veterans credit provisions and non-disabled veterans credit provisions? Is that not our territory?
I'm going to ask counsel to answer your question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I didn't flag those sections because they're not under the committee's jurisdiction. It's just section one the committee's looking at.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Lentz. Senator Marty. Senate File 2106.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 2106 is a simple bill to expand who can solemnize marriages. Right now, the law allows judges or retired judges to perform marriages, and or it says also any judge in a court of record. And of the judges who are not judicial branch but executive branch, Office of Administrative Hearings, Tax Court, Workers' Comp Court, the Tax Court explicitly says they are judges of court of record. And I have a constituent here, Mr. Nielsen, whose daughter is getting married and his sister is an administrative law judge, and asked why they were different. And so we contacted the Office of Administrative Hearings, and Chief Judge Krause sent us a good memo explaining the situation, and maybe he can just give you a real brief summary. It's not something they were asking for, but it seems to fit in with the way it was. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Raymond Krause, and I am the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state of Minnesota. When Senator Marty's office and Representative Scalzi's office in the House called my office asking for information on this bill, I was able to help in that. I used to be on the tax court, and before I was chief judge at the OAH. And I had wondered when I came over to OAH why there was a difference, and so I'd done just some digging around to see what the difference was. And the only difference, we're both executive branch courts. We're structured the same. We operate the same. We are both, testimony is taken down on the record, which is part of the definition of a court of record. And so there was no seeming rationale for a distinction between the tax court, the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, and OAH. I then, just again, out of more or less curiosity, contacted Judge Dwayne Harvis, who was the first chief judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and former legislator Tex Sebin, who was the author of the bill that created OAH, and asked them the question why there was a difference, and both of them said, well, I'm not sure even what a court of record is, and it just never occurred to us to put that wording in when we created OAH. And so that was essentially my report back to Senator Marty and Representative Scalza. The creating or designating the Office of Administrative Hearings as a court of record has no other impact. There's no other consequence of that. It just recognizes that, similar to the tax court, our testimony is taken down on the record, and then we fit under the statute that allows solemnization of marriages. Again, as Senator Marty said, this is not our bill. This is not something we asked for, but it's not something we have any problem with either. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take those.
Any questions for the judge? Senator
thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this taking care of a problem that's coming up? And I'm sorry, I was in a little discussion here.
I'd like to have Mr. Nielsen speak briefly to why we came up with the bill.
Okay.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes. My name is Larry Nielsen. I live in Vadnais Heights, Minnesota. Senator Marty is my senator. I have two children. One is a son and one is a daughter. My daughter is getting married in October of this year. She got engaged last October, and I have a sister who graduated from the University of Minnesota Law School about 4 years after I did. I graduated from law school at the U in 1974, and when she graduated and passed the bar exam, it was my honor to move for her admission to the Minnesota State Bar to practice law here. She's been an administrative law judge for about 20 years, and when my daughter became engaged, I thought it would be a wonderful thing for our family if my sister could preside over her niece's wedding. And I started to investigate whether or not administrative law judges could perform weddings and discovered that they were not allowed to do so. And I contacted my local senator and representative, and they were kind enough to introduce these bills that are now before you. I would like to thank Senator Marty and the other co-sponsors of this bill and simply request that it go forward. Obviously, I know my sister quite well. She's been an administrative law judge for approximately 20 years, and I believe she and the other administrative law judges have the honesty and integrity to certainly perform weddings as well as make significant decisions that affect all of us in this state. But that's the basic reason I contacted Senator Marty and my representative. The bill is being introduced at my request. Thank you.
Is there further discussion? Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, sounds like a good bill. So what we're just doing is expanding from judges to administrative judges. And what's the difference between
sure,
that?
Sure.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, we found out in looking at this that tax court judges are already able to do it, and in effect of the administrative branch judges, workers' comp judges are in the Office of Administrative Hearings, and so one of the types of administrative branch judges, the tax court judges, have the authority to do this, and these other administrative judges do not have the ability to. And I don't know if you were here when Chief Judge Krause was talking about earlier, but he asked the author of the bill originally, former Representative Tex Sebin, why they didn't include it as court of record. And he said, well, they didn't really know what court of record was anyway. And so we're just simply changing that. If tax court counts as a court of record, this should be as well. This is not something I think is going to be a huge change. Some judges do perform a lot of weddings. I think Mr. Nielsen's sister is doing it for her daughter, her niece. That's the only reason she wants to. And it just seems to be consistent with what we're doing with tax court judges.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, are there other types of judges that are not included in this? I mean, my question would be, why not include all judges if you're going to, you know, start picking out different types of judges?
Mr. Chairman, I think this does bring in all the judges then.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the questions that Senator Hall was raising, when Senator Marty brought this to me, I was frankly surprised that administrative law judges couldn't perform marriages. I agree. I, as far as I know, this will bring into the loop all judges. You know, for certain district court judges can perform marriages as well as appellate court judges. And just parenthetically, I have a friend of mine who is a retired court administrator from Wilmer, Minnesota, and she can perform marriages under existing law. If you look, it's retired court administrator is allowed to perform them. So I think this, frankly, is a good idea and just kind of modernize the statute a little bit. So those are the reasons why I signed on to the bill.
Sounds good.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. Senator Marty moves that Senate File 2106 be recommended to pass and move to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Nielsen?
Yes.
Give our best wishes to the wedding party.
Thank you.
Senator Hall. Members, we're passing out a new fiscal note for Senator Hall's bill. You have a preliminary report in your packets, but we're going to be following the new one that's being passed out as we speak. Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair and members, the bill before you has to do with those that cannot afford an attorney in criminal or child protection matters. And I would move Senate File 1678 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Finance. Mr. Chair, I do have a delete all amendment, and wonder if we should deal with that first.
Okay. Senator Hall, this is an author's amendment. This is the primary jurisdiction that this bill is in. Senator Hall moves. What's the number of your amendment?
Amendment 5.
A5. Senator Hall moves the A5 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill was brought to me by Kevin Kyer, the Executive Director of the Public Defender's Office, and John Tuma from the Minnesota Inter-County Association. They are here today and will explain the bill's details. Although you do have a detail and summary in your packet. The goal of this legislation and the reason I've offered it, it was to create a better certainty around the question of who represents those who cannot afford an attorney in criminal child protection. Unfortunately, due to the lack of clarity in our statutes, our counties and public defenders have been expanding significant amount of resources on appeals around the question of who is to provide for this representation. Therefore, we do have Mr. Kyer and Mr. Tuma that are here that will share the framework of this and answer questions.
Who wishes to speak first? Mr. Kyer, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. For the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'd like to thank Senator Hall for bringing this bill forward. As he mentioned, this is really about clarifying responsibilities between the state and the counties. But it's also about bringing some statewide consistency to the criminal and juvenile justice system.
Mr. Kyer, could you pull the microphone up real
sure.
close?
And also, Mr. Chairman, about clarifying responsibilities between the legislative and judicial branches regarding the oversight and funding of these activities. As Senator Hall mentioned, this is a compromise. There are a number of provisions in here we're not particularly happy with. I know there are provisions in here the counties aren't necessarily happy about. But that's what compromise is, and that's what we're bringing forward to you today. Some of the issues we're dealing with in this bill date back to beginning of state assumption of public defender costs, back to the 1980s and early 1990s. As is the case with many of these kind of state assumptions, some of the issues were misunderstood, some of them were overlooked, some of them were just not clear. Over the last several years, those of you who have been around here a while have seen competing bills coming from public defenders, from prosecutors, from counties. There have been lawsuits in the courts regarding who represents who. There have been court decisions that have impacted who represents what parties in these cases. Last year, we spoke with you, Mr. Chairman, and a number of members on the committee. You asked us to come back with some kind of resolution of some of these, hopefully at no cost or very little cost, given the budget situation. This is our best shot at it. And so we have included a number of folks in terms of talking to people, prosecutors, the courts, obviously the counties, public defenders, and have come up with our best effort here. Since that time, some of you are aware of the case of Randolph that the Minnesota State Supreme Court decided, in which the right of appeal in misdemeanor cases was affirmed and that the state would be responsible for those costs. Right now, the Department of Management budget is paying for those costs out of a general contingency fund. Obviously, that's not a long-term solution to misdemeanor appeal representation. This bill also addresses that. So, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to go through it section by section. Mr. Toome and I will alternate in terms of sections and obviously stand for any questions that you all might have. So,
please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Section 1 eliminates the right to representation in the appeal of end-of-confinement review cases. These are the cases where people are coming out of some kind of confinement. They are designated as 1, 2, or 3 in terms of community notification hearings. This is the appeal of those decisions where there's a statutory right to counsel. This is the only area in the appellate office that has where there's a statutory right as opposed to a constitutional right to representation. This is an area where it's tied to Section 9 of the bill, where that same office would then take over misdemeanor appeals. And therefore, when you see the fiscal note, what we're projecting is there really isn't any cost because we're basically trading one service for another. So that's Section 1. That statutory right was created back in the 1990s. If there are questions beyond this or when we get to questions, we do have a one-page handout. Mr. Stewart's here to obviously answer any questions about that.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Toome. I'm with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Section 2, which starts on page 2, 2.10, is a provision that was brought to us when we were putting this bill together and talking to the courts. This was brought to us by former Senator Knutson, now judge down in Dakota County. And he noticed that when he was doing paternity cases, there was several individuals taking advantage of this statute because of the way it was drafted. Senator Knutson pointed out to us that if you start a paternity suit and just say, I don't have anything to do with this individual, we'll end up representing that person all the way through all of his family law matters. Where if you're an honest person and said, yes, I'm responsible, you get no representation at all. And so he noticed a lot of people were abusing the statute. And so one of the solutions we came up to is to limit the right to this appeal. What happens in counties right now is we represent essentially the state to reduce our welfare expenditures. We represent the mother to approve paternity so that we can establish that someone else is responsible for paying some of this child support, and so that it reduces their welfare benefit. So it's a good thing, and counties have been doing this for a number of years. If the father is indigent, obviously we have to provide also the representation for him. And so in this situation, we're saying we're only providing representation to you on the question of paternity. Are you the father or not? And it limits it so that we're not representing them on their child support payments or their visitation stuff. That's the stuff that you can pay for, everybody else pays for family law stuff, and the county should not be paying for that. Your taxpayers should not be paying for that. So it just limits it to your right to have counsel for the question of paternity.
Mr. Chairman, Section 3 is also on page 2, line 2.18. This section clarifies who pays for the costs where there is standby or advisory counsel, and states that the Board of Public Defense will not provide those services. This is a, right now, kind of a mishmash all across the state, depending on what county you're in. This, again, is an attempt to not only clarify but also bring some consistency, and you will notice throughout the bill there are provisions where it mentions standby and advisory counsel, which are two separate things. Again, it brings consistency about who pays, provides clarity regarding advisory and standby counsel. This doesn't occur a lot, and I think you will see that in the fiscal note that the court submitted. Where it becomes especially difficult for us, if in fact we do get these appointments, is it takes a public defender out of the rotation. And so what happens is they're not available to cover other calendars or, frankly, in rural areas, other counties. And so that makes it really difficult, particularly, as I said, in the rural areas. Section 4 on page 3, beginning on line 3.5, provides that the court shall inquire about the ability of parents, guardians, or custodians to pay for counsel in juvenile proceedings, and allows court-ordered reimbursement in those cases. Again, this is just like the adult criminal statutes that you all passed several years ago regarding reimbursement. We don't expect a lot here, but again, trying to make it consistent with what we do with criminal cases, that if there is the ability to pay, that somebody should be at least making some partial reimbursement.
Mr. Chair, and members, Section 5 really is the meat of what the counties are here for. About 3 years ago, we were ordered by the Supreme Court to provide representation to adults in child protection cases. We felt the statute was very thin on our obligation to provide this, but the court had ruled. And counties, being good administrators, took up the task of providing this representation to parents in child protection cases. And we hired counsel on contracts. Each county has contracts with law firms, typically in their communities, to provide representation to the adults. And it's actually worked out quite well. The courts estimated that the cost would have been twice as much if the state would have taken it over than what the counties have been able to do it for. And so what this particular statute does is to clearly state in the statute that counties are responsible for the representation of adults in child protection matters. Because the statute was somewhat thin that they decided on, some of the normal reimbursement provisions and also kind of giving detail to who should be appointed was really not in the statute. And so what we were looking for is some certainty as the counties go forward as to what our obligations are. And so you see at line 410, is kind of where a lot of this discussion starts, the new section F. And basically what that says is that counties will provide that representation. When you show up for the initial hearing, at a minimum, we're going to have one attorney there to represent the parents' interests. That doesn't mean they're going to represent all of the different varying interests that might be there. You could have a father who is in prison in Ohio, and you could have the stepfather and stepmom, or the real mom, at the court hearing. We know they have differing interests, and the courts will deal with that. That person can ask for an attorney at that initial hearing. But it starts out with just one of the attorneys we have selected. And then what it also indicates is that the court will appoint the attorneys that we have hired to do this. The county elected county board does these contracts. So this is not the prosecutor picking the defense attorney. The county board actually makes that decision. That was what the county board was doing 2 decades ago and prior, when it was a completely state or completely county-run court system. The county board is the one who selected those individuals. So it's not a there's no conflict there. If the court does find a conflict, the county will go out and contract with another attorney. But they must do it in consultation with the chief district judge in that area, so that the judges have a say in who we're selecting, so that they're not just some rookie off the street. And then finally, Section G indicates that we're willing to make sure that these individuals have some minimum qualifications that we contract with, that they have at least 2 years of experience in doing child protection cases, and that experience requirement is established by the Judicial Council, or that they've taken a course that is approved by the Judicial Council, so that when we're sending in people to represent families in these very complicated child protection cases, we are sending people who are trained and ready to handle that. This is a critical piece for counties so that we can identify what our risks are and we can manage it. The courts have been playing very nice with us since this change has occurred. They have been only appointing our attorneys that we've been hiring to do this. But you can certainly have a judge somewhere in the future say, my law clerk has just started a law firm, and I'm going to, in my court, we're going to appoint him, and he's going to be charged this much for these services. And all of a sudden, it all unravels the system we've been able to manage and keep a very cost-effective to assure that families get quality representation. Section 6 of the bill.
Mr. Chair, did you want to wait till we're done before we ask questions? Or?
Well, we have time. You could ask questions.
Oh, just real quickly, you mentioned it would cost more to do the state to get in the process than the county. Can you just real quickly tell me why that is?
Mr. Chairman?
Maybe you did.
I didn't, Mr. Chairman. It's a good question, Senator Ingebrigtsen, Mr. Chair. When this lawsuit was coming through, it was SLJ, state versus SLJ. It was a Rice County case and also combined with a Crow Wing County case. And as we were going through the process, it wasn't clear who was going to pick this cost up. It could have been the public defenders. It could have been the court administration. It could have been us. Court administration made estimates in several counties where this would be taken over, particularly in Rice and Crow Wing, where the lawsuits were occurring from. We lost the case, and of course, immediately Rice County and Goodhue County went out and contracted for services that were still up in there, who was going to provide it. We were able to do it for less than half of what was estimated by the court administration at that time 3 years ago when the litigation was coming through. And so counties are able to do that because they were able to find law firms that were willing to do this on a loss leader basis. They take these cases because they know they're going to get a certain set of cases from the courts, and then they're able to then manage their caseload better by doing that, as opposed to an attorney that may be just appointed on a random basis. You're just appointed. You're going to bill your full billable rate then of probably $120 to $180 an hour in some jurisdictions. Here we're able to get most of the contracts in the neighborhood of $70 to $80 an hour because they know they're going to get a certain set of cases to work
Thank
from.
You.
Mr. Tuma, I had a question going down to line 4, 23, and 24. These are the requirements or qualifications. The first one has a minimum of 2 years experience in handling child protection cases. The second option would be to receive training in handling a child protection case of only one course. How much time is involved in taking a course?
We would not know that. As you know, the way this is set up, Mr. Chairman, is that the Judicial Council will establish what the approved course is. And so we work this out with the court administration and the Judicial Council folks as to what they're looking for. We do have a juvenile justice group that gets together and meets on these subjects. And my guess is that the Judicial Council, and I'm sure the courts can speak to this if they want to, but the Judicial Council will ask this task force for juvenile hearings to set up a course. How many hours it will be, I have no idea. It's up to the Judicial Council to set that.
I'm kind of concerned about the proportionality of one course compared to 2 years of active experience. I'm not sure if one course can justify that same time frame.
I would be if I were setting it, Mr. Chairman, but I think the Judicial Council, the judges who will actually be having these people in front of them, are going to be pretty demanding as far as what that course will include and the expectations from those individuals that will be standing in front of them. And so I'm pretty confident that it's going to be a pretty robust course that they have to pass. The Section 6, Mr. Chairman, line 4.28, is almost identical to Section 4 that Mr. Kyer just talked about. It's the ability for us to get partial reimbursement in these child protection cases if we find that the parents have resources to pay. And I'll pass it on to Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and members,
Mr. Kyer.
Section 7 begins on page 5, line 5.13, and this refers to pre-sentence investigations. Again, this clarifies that the appellate attorney has access to the pre-trial or the pre-sentence investigation reports at the trial level, and that they then can be included in the general records request that the appellate attorney has. There is some conflicting language and some specific language that says basically only the trial attorney gets that right now. And so right now what we have to do is we scramble to the individual counties, or there are occasions where we have to go to the Court of Appeals to get an order to get the pre-sentence investigation. It's already there. It's already in the file. All we want to say is it's included in the general records request.
Mr. Chair, members.
Pardon me, Mr. Tuma. Mr. Kyer, on pre-sentence investigations, the availability of the report is one thing. Are they also available to any research data that may have led to the report? Is that also available?
Mr. Chairman and members, as I understand it, if it's part of the court record, if it was the private side, no, that you would just then get the pre-sentence investigation. I don't know, maybe, So there are provisions to keep private things like witness identification, things like that. So we're not asking for that. All we're saying is whatever that pre-sentence investigation says and the circumstances behind it are issues regarding appeal. And we end up getting them. It's just a very cumbersome process to get them.
All right. Mr. Truma.
Mr. Chair, Section 8 is a petty misdemeanor certification. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around this provision. It was part of the bill that passed last year out of this body. You heard it last year. It was vetoed by the governor, but it's our understanding that he vetoed that bill as regards to something totally different than this provision. It was regarding the income qualifications that he vetoed the bill. This provision simply requires the court to inquire as to whether the prosecutor is going to certify the misdemeanor as a petty. That's all it says. And the only reason for this is to encourage everybody out there to ask that question early on so that Kevin's folks don't have to open up a file because they don't represent petty misdemeanors. This has nothing to do with the changes the court is considering regarding its rules as to what they refer to as, I'm going to forget the name, that where you payable offenses, the payable offense stuff that you've asked the court to look at. There's nothing to do with that. Okay, this is just simply if the local prosecutor is choosing to certify it, we just want to let the public defenders know that in advance so they don't open a file and waste the time of opening that file.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 9 starts on page 6, line 6.4, and adds misdemeanor appeals to the responsibilities of the Public Defense Board. Section 10 eliminates some obsolete language that dates back to the judge-appointed system that that Mr. Tuma referred to earlier. Some of these language actually dates back, I think, as early as the 1960s. This broad language has occasionally been used to appoint public defenders in cases where the defendant doesn't qualify for service or other types of cases. Again, it's not something that happens routinely. It's not something that happens even once in a while, but there have been these issues. And again, we're trying to clean these up, trying to make sure that the clarification of who pays for what. Mr. Chairman, Section 11 begins on line 6.27. This is the one that had some substantial changes, as you know. What the attempt here is to tighten the eligibility for public defender services. It mandates the use of a statewide eligibility form. prohibits the appointment of a public defender in cases where the defendant refuses to execute the eligibility statement or waives appointment of the public defender. It makes it clear that the public defender will not provide standby counsel and adds language again about the payment of counsel, again, consistent with those juvenile statutes that we mentioned earlier. And also, if it didn't come out, it allows for a partial payment of the public defender copayment. We have had some instances where judges have refused to order the copayment because somebody maybe couldn't afford the $75, and their hands were tied that they couldn't order some partial payment of the copayment. Mr. Chairman, Section 12, beginning on line 8.2 on page 8, or 8.20, again, deletes some obsolete and broad language regarding the appointment of public defenders in appellate cases, again, similar to the previous provision. Section 13 allows for partial payment of public defender reimbursements. Again, if a court orders reimbursement and for whatever reason the defendant can't pay that entire amount, it allows a partial payment. It also eliminates a step or a procedure in the process, and there's a repealer in the back of the bill that also relates to that. What we're saying is that once the determination is made, once the eligibility form is provided, that really is the item that should determine what kind of reimbursement somebody pays for, that there's not another procedure or step that the court has to go through. Mr. Chairman, Section 14 on page 9 is on 9.28. Again, that adds misdemeanor appeals to the list of services that the chief appellate defender will provide. And Section 15, which is on page 10, line 10.13, again, includes standby counsel as those items which the public defenders won't provide, again, making it consistent with the other parts of the statute and with the other parts of the bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, members, Section 16, again, cleans up some of that language that was left over from the takeover. In this, it indicates that the state public defenders are supposed to pick up some services that were indicated in an original budget back in January 1 of 1990. Actually, I looked for this diligently. I actually turned up the legislative library upside and down because our case in SLJ hinged on this particular language. And if I could have found somewhere this old document, I probably could have proved that Kevin would have lost that case. But I couldn't find it, and so it really. So I hope no one finds it later and proves I was right. But it really is old language left over as we transitioned. The takeover of the state public defenders and court system, as you remember, wasn't an immediate, we're going to do it this year, this minute, this second. It happened over a decade of time. And it created a lot of complications as far as how we divvy up the money and who pays for what. And so what we do with this new section is to just state what the present law is as far as our relationships. If it doesn't say that we provide the services specifically in 611, counties don't provide it. The one exception to this statute is for the state of Hennepin, who still does its own public defense in Minnesota. They pay for it. They wanted to keep it back when we did the transfer, and they still are doing the public defense in Hennepin County. So they're kind of in a different world than the rest of the state. Section 17, pretrial appeal reimbursements. This is the challenging one that we've had a lot of interaction back and forth between the county attorneys, the public defender's offices, and several individuals trying to get our heads around solving this question. This is our best shot at it. We're always willing to listen to wiser people than ourselves. But what we attempt to do here is, under the rules of court, if a county attorney appeals a pretrial order, so in other words, I want to put in a piece of evidence and the court rules against me, and I want to appeal that before I actually go to trial, then that appeal goes up before the trial starts, and the county is responsible for paying the defense costs on that appeal. Win or lose, they pay for it. In the past, the Court of Appeals, the District Court of Appeals, or the actual Court of Appeals itself, would set the attorney's appeal rate for that defense attorney. They were typically doing it at a couple $1,000s flat rate. That's what you get on these appeals. They kind of undone that a few years ago where they started to actually take in evidence as far as what those charges were, and all of a sudden counties were getting bills in the neighborhood of $15,000, $16,000 for these appeals. And so it's been kind of a bone of contention with the county attorneys. Mr. Kyer and I have been trying to look for solutions. This is probably iteration number 55 of what we're trying to figure out as far as a reasonable solution to this question. And so what we suggested is that in the statute it specifically states, as a statutory obligation, counties are required to pay for the representation of the defendant on appeal. They select an attorney to do that, and we'll pay for that. In order to provide some cost constraints around that, we suggest that the chief judge of each of the 10 districts establish the rate for that district, an hourly rate of whatever, $100, $125, whatever the going rate would be for that area, after consultation with the public defenders, the prosecutors, and the local bar. And that there would be a $5,000 cap, and I'm going to call it a soft cap, on those fees, after which that attorney, if he felt that his appeal was of such unusual character or duration, he could ask that chief judge to increase it above $5,000. The reason we can't have a hard cap is there is a Supreme Court case that does not allow the legislature in judicial matters as a separation of powers issue establish a hard cap on attorney's fees. It was actually a workers' comp case, and I actually remember it because I was practicing workers' comp at the time it came through back in the early 1990s. And it basically says as a separation of power issue, you can't set a hard cap. And so what we tried to do here is essentially put in statute what would be, we think, a reasonable compromise of $5,000, but we have to have at least some sort of off-ramp to allow an attorney to say, look, this was, you know, the biggest appeal that there ever was in the history of mankind, and I certainly could not do it for $5,000. The last thing, Mr. Chairman, is the repealer, and that is just repealing the provisions that were in the bill last year, that same one that was vetoed. It's simply getting rid of the reimbursement standards found in the court or in the statutes. Apparently, the Judiciary Council can do that just fine. The courts can do that just fine. And so we're getting rid of that. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, this bill is not what we call a love fest. It's a peace in the valley bill. Okay, if it was a love fest, we would be coming here in front of you and asking for $40 million, 10 for the counties, 10 for Kevin, 10 for the courts, and 10 for John Kingery's folks, and say, we're all happy. Then we would be happy. But that's not it. A peace in the valley bill is where we all give a little bit. We're not all very happy, but we'll get along. And I think that's important because what we're talking about here is having those people where government really happens out there in the courtrooms around the state of Minnesota focus on their jobs and start working together. We've been fighting for the last decade, and we're coming in front of you, we think, with something that gives us some peace in the valley so they can focus on providing quality representation for victims and for children who are in need of protection. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, we encourage your support.
Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tuma, I have two questions. The first is whether or not there's going to be peace in Newman's Valley. I represent four rural counties, and when I go home, I undoubtedly are going to be contacted by county commissioners on an issue of the county undertaking certain court expenses. And I'm looking for assurances from you that rural counties have been included in this discussion, and to the extent that you are able, you can represent to me that they have participated and they are in agreement with this.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Tillman. Newman, I'll let Nancy Showalter answer that question, the policy chair for or the public safety chair for AMC. I believe the answer is yes. I mean, anybody can look at one particular piece of this legislation and say, boy, we got hosed on this one. You know, this appeals language doesn't work. And you can say, well, yeah, it's not the best thing in the world, but you have to put it in the full context. When you look at the controls and the cost savings that we can incur through some of the child protection provisions here and knowing the certainty of what our costs are, I think are well outweigh the losses that we may incur in the appellate area. But frankly, I think we gain in the appellate area if the chief judge in that district uses some good fiscal restraint and understands that these bills should just not be approved willy-nilly. And so there are always some risks, but I'll let Commissioner Schulweiler answer that in more detail because she sat through those meetings. I did not. So,
is Commissioner Showalter here?
Yes, she is.
Welcome to the committee. We also have others that wish to give testimony, perhaps not so much in favor of the bill, but we don't want to forget Mark Nybold or Michael Harrison, so they'll be coming up next. Please proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Schulweiler. I'm chair of the Association of Minnesota Counties Public Safety Committee. And to answer the senator's question, our process is these issues go through our committee process. We have members of all counties, all sizes. Anyone who wants to sit on those committees are allowed from each representative from each county. And so we discuss them in full. And they go through a vote in the committee process, and then they move on through the General Assembly of the entire membership of the Association of Minnesota Counties through our annual conference, and they get voted on there. So this is a process that has participation from members of counties throughout the state at various stages.
Senator Newman, did you have any further questions?
Yeah, I did have a follow-up question, if I might.
Please
for
proceed.
Mr. Tuma. If you could go, Mr. Tuma, to Subdivision 16 on page 11. This is the appeals regarding the pretrial orders and the soft cap that you were talking about of $5,000. I just want to make sure that I understand that if a prosecuting attorney brings this appeal and asks a judge for attorney's fees in excess of $5,000, the county is the unit that is on the hook for the $5,000. It's not the public defenders. Am I correct on that?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman. The county attorney would bring the action. It would be the attorney who is hired to represent the individual who would actually then file the claim for the additional fees to the county. If he goes over $5,000, he has to ask for this order from the chief judge before the county is obligated to pay his bill. So it is the county paying the defender, the defense attorney's bill is what's going on here. And it's because of the county attorney decided to bring the appeal. He can certainly give his side of the story if he thinks it's not an unusual character to the chief judge, and certainly that would be a matter for the chief judge to deal with. This is not unusual. Actually, the chief judges are the ones who actually set expert witness fees in each of the jurisdictions. So they're involved in kind of doing this similar activity. So it's not like something new we're giving them to do. It is new, but it's not a new kind of process. They've been doing this in defense issues with regards to expert witnesses for as long as I've been practicing law, which is longer than I want to know.
Thank you, Mr. Toulman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
She has a little more testimony. Would that be all right to give?
Please. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Intercounty Association support Senator Hall's bill, Senate File 1678, and appreciate his willingness to bring the parties together to develop compromise legislation. Over two decades ago, counties were the government entity that essentially provided representation of those who could not afford legal counsel in criminal and child protection matters. This was paid for through a combination of property taxes and state aid known back then as HACA. In the 1990s, there was an effort in the state legislature and supported by the courts, public defenders, and counties to have the state take over funding of the courts and public defense. As part of this takeover, The counties gave up HACA to the Board of Public Defense to take over representation of those who could not afford it. Unfortunately, the statutes defining who is entitled to representation did not always keep up with the changes in the financial obligations. Adding to the problem were tighter budgets and new court cases expanding the rights of representation in both criminal and child protection matters. This has resulted in expanding conflict between the court, public defenders, and counties, resulting in several costly litigations that have yet to fully resolve the disputes on these financial and representation matters. On behalf of the counties, we want to support this legislation. It is a good first step to resolving all of these disputes. This bill is certainly not everything counties would like. We would rather that the state honor what we understood as their commitment two decades ago and pay for all of the representations of those who cannot afford it, thus relieving our property taxpayers from another mandate that has been expanding over the recent years. Even though we did not feel that we were obligated under the law to represent adults in child protection cases, counties have stepped up to the plate. In every jurisdiction that has taken over this area of representation, we have done it far more cost-effectively than was anticipated, and we have been told by those who practice in the system that it has actually improved the quality of the service. This means that children are being placed appropriately at a much faster pace, and matters are being resolved with fewer burdens on the court system. The changes in this bill will help build on that system of protecting our most vulnerable. It will create better certainty in the budgeting process for both counties and the Board of Public Defense. Most importantly, it will help create a more cooperative environment between the policymakers at the court level. This will allow our innovative energies to improve the system as opposed to trying to figure out which statute we could litigate to shift the costs onto other partners. Therefore, in conclusion, we thank Senator Hall and all of the co-authors of this legislation for encouraging a meaningful cooperative resolution to a very difficult subject that has vexed us for over the last decade. Thank you, and I'm open for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Hearing none. Oh, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Did this bill then come from the counties? Remind me what the genesis of the bill was. Was it a county effort because of the funding issues?
That was a great portion of it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. That was a great part of it. It became a platform issue for the Association of Minnesota counties because we were now expected to take on all of this expense. And so when the two court cases, when those were decided and we had that responsibility under the Supreme Court, then we wanted to clarify those issues that weren't settled in the court cases through this legislation and make sure everything was clear as to who had what responsibility.
Senator McGuire, the problems that have kind of vexed the public defenders for a number of years is it's been brewing for quite some time. Senator Meemaw, who was chairman prior to this particular committee, also was struggling with it. We then also had the Randolph decision that just came out earlier, was it this year or last year, which they gave warning signals to the legislature a few years back that the appeal process involving public defenders was something that the state needed to pay for. That, too, is incorporated in this bill. So this is a collection of issues that, in working together with the parties, have arrived at this as a compromise. We will, by law, we have to solve that problem that the Supreme Court gave us in the case of Randolph. And as a result, the bill is before us. And so it's been brewing for quite some time, and it goes through a number of different disciplines, not just county government, but also just the administration of the Public Defense Board. And so this has been brewing for quite some
time. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you for that background. Since I wasn't here those years, these are issues that we think they need to be moved forward. I always am nervous about making decisions just based on funding, lack of funding. So I know you have more testifiers, but I'd like to ask the different parties if they feel that this is a good step forward, that it's a start, we should do more, or if it's not a good step forward because it's just a funding issue. But I'm hoping that they're going to say it's a good step forward. Maybe we just should go further. But I would love to ask the different parties just what their sense of that is. But if you want to take more testimony, and then I can get that question answered.
Senator McGuire, I'm going to take you up on your offer. We're going to finish up the testifying. And then as those individuals give testimony, we'll let these witnesses ponder your request.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Mr. Nyvold. Welcome to the committee. And if Mr. Harrison is in the room, he could also approach the table. If Mr. Harrison is, he is here. All right. Mr. Nyvold, why don't you begin?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Nyvold. I'm a private attorney in St. Paul. I've been practicing law since about 1981 and handling primarily criminal matters and with a specialty in criminal appeals since about 1987. I have, since about 1989, had a contract with the state public defender to do what you'd consider direct appeals, defendants who've been convicted or pled guilty and want to appeal their cases. In the early 90s, it was brought to my attention by the public defender's office that there are these pretrial appeals. Add to our caseload. The rules provide for private attorneys to get paid for these. Would you like to do them? And since then, I and a number of other attorneys have gotten cases, pretrial appeals, referred to us by the state public defender's office. And again, I've been doing that almost 20 years, and I think that's probably more than the others who are currently doing it. Over the years, I've had occasion to testify about pretrial appeals and the attorney fee provision. It's been buffeted somewhat by criticism, and there's some concerns about it. Let me try and shed a little light on why that fee or the idea of an attorney fee is a good idea, and then comment on the legislation and suggest some things that I think could be changed to make sure that the attorney's fees are fair and accomplish the policy goals that underlie them. There's a tendency just to look at the fact of the cost involved in this. Mr. Tuma mentioned an appeal of like $15,000, $16,000. I don't doubt that there have been a few of those. I've been doing these for 20 years. The most I've ever gotten is about $4,500. And I don't like to throw these numbers out, but I think we need to get past that so I can talk about the policy reasons. I went back and looked at my business records for the last 3 years. In 2011, I got paid. Doesn't mean I did the appeal that year, but I got paid in 2011 for six of these. My average fee was about $3,269. 2010, I did seven pretrial appeals referred from the state public defender. My average fee was $2,871. In 2009, I did eight, and the average fee was $2,784. So there may be some attorneys out there who set a high hourly rate and who present the counties with a big bill. That is a rarity. That is not what typically happens. I do more of these, I think, than probably most attorneys in the state, I don't think anyone does any more than I do. And those fees, again, are, I think, you know, what the market has to pay some attorneys who have very high fee schedules. But again, it's the court that has control over that. But I'm not submitting, and the other attorneys who do these appeals with me, referred from the state public defender, are not setting high fee rates. My fee is about $135 an hour. Many private attorneys charge double or triple that, and that's where you get into some of these higher fees. Nonetheless, I think the idea of a cap makes sense as long as there's a provision to exceed it in exceptional cases where the work is very complex and extended. But the policy reasons I wanted to talk about, I suggest that a fee be remain competitive with what it is now. Now, I'm not saying that $135, that's all I would take. It's not up to me to do that. I recognize that there are expenses and the cost of government is going up. I'm open to taking a reasonable percentage reduction in that. But the concern I have is that the means by which that is done won't take into account what a reasonable and fair fee will accomplish. First of all, if the fee is set too low, then the number of these appeals increase because prosecutors take into account right now the fact that they have to pay a fee. They tend not to appeal the marginal cases because they're going to pay money for it and they know that the chances of getting the case reversed are small. If the fee gets set too low, then your savings are illusory because they will appeal more of these. Why will they appeal more? Because they've got a victim who is saying, I've been wronged and this case is being thrown out. I want you to appeal it. The prosecutor may well know he or she is not going to win that appeal, but they've got a victim pressuring them. They may have the police who say, you need to support us, appeal this decision. Again, the prosecutor, at least at present, can say, you know, we're not going to win and I have to pay a fee. If the fee goes down significantly, then it's a matter of trying to defend a decision not to appeal the case, which, again, the prosecutor may well know he or she will not win. And just as an example, in 2011, the rulings that I helped support on appeal, 4 out of 6 times they were affirmed. In 2011, they were affirmed 3 out of 7, and in 2009, it was 4 out of 8. That's a pretty low win percentage for the prosecution because in direct appeals, they're probably winning where a defendant has to try and get his conviction overturned. They're probably winning about 85 to 95% of the time. So these appeals are often not successful. The right to appeal should exist. If there's a bad decision, it ought to be reversed. But again, the tendency to appeal these needs to be curbed. The other reason to keep the number of pretrial appeals low is it increases the caseload of the appellate courts. And again, the cost savings on one end may be met by an increased cost on the other end, which is the appellate courts have to deal with more cases, need more judges, need more staff. And that's one reason why I think since 1992 the appellate courts have gone along with the idea that a private attorney can get these cases referred to him or her, and they will pay a reasonable fee. The first time I did this, I didn't know if the appellate court was going to say, the state public defender can handle all of these. We're not going to pay you a fee. It started with the state public defender. Let them keep it. But they didn't do that. And although no one in the courts has ever told me this, I think it makes sense that over 20 years where they continually recognize this provision or this practice of referring these cases out, that they see it as a way to check or stem the flow of pretrial appeals and keep their caseload within manageable limits. If the fee is set at a rate at a level that is not competitive, at least competitive or close to what is being paid now, you'll have a situation where attorneys who are less experienced will be handling the cases. And these are significant and serious cases. Some of them are relatively simple. They don't take a lot of effort. But some of them involve highly complex issues and very serious cases. You've got confessions in first-degree murder cases that are suppressed. You've got evidence suppressed in criminal sexual conduct cases. These are rulings that can take a significant amount of effort to defend. And sometimes judges, although they reach the right result, don't give the right reasons. And the appellate attorney then has to try to supply the right reasons to support what is an otherwise correct decision. So they take a great deal of experience and can take a great deal of experience and effort to successfully defend. The other consideration is that if you have pay a competitive fee and you get good representation in these appeals, you'll be able to defend good rulings. Now, the ruling that works in favor of the defendant now is a ruling that works in favor of the rest of us tomorrow. So there's a tendency of judges, if their rulings are not upheld, they stop making that type of ruling. So there is an impact on the state of jurisprudence and what is the law, and whether defendants can get favorable rulings when they're otherwise entitled to them. The idea of the chief judge handling or setting the fee creates some problems. I think there's some good aspects to it, but I think some overall they weigh against the considerations weigh against having a chief judge. The chief judges do it. First of all, there are 10 of them, so it's a matter of having possibly different rates set in different parts of the state. The legislation provides that they'll get input from members of the private bar, but it says in their district. The way it's working now, very few, if any, of these pretrial appeals are, since it would include the private bar, there could be a number of private attorneys in the district who do these, but the lion's share would be handled by attorneys who aren't in the outlying districts in the state. So I'm not sure how much their input would be helpful, because they're not doing a lot of these, and the attorneys down here are doing them, and the cost of living in the Twit metro area tends to be higher than it is in the outlying judicial districts. Chief judge may also be influenced by rates that he or she is setting in other types of cases and not appreciate what goes into a pretrial appeal. The district chief judges in the district just, I don't think, have a handle on what is required to, what kind of representation is required in these appeals, how long it takes, and the difficulty of it. Again, I realize they'll get input, but I don't think they're going to appreciate these other considerations, that the fee needs to be set high enough to keep the level of appeals low, to ensure that experienced attorneys get them and handle them appropriately. That, I think, will just sort of become lost in the process of consulting with the local bar and the county attorneys and the chief defender. You have to be doing them to sort of appreciate what's at stake. I don't have an alternative person to suggest to set the fees. I think originally the legislation called for the state public defender to do that. Since this legislation would apply to all attorneys, whether the case was referred from the state public defender or not, I'm not sure the state public defender is the appropriate entity to set that fee. But I would suggest it be a single entity, not 10 chief district judges, and that person be able to get input from any attorney, not just attorneys who are in one district. Again, I wish I had a person to suggest, but if the input can come from attorneys across the board, I think that will help suggest or indicate why the rate needs to stay at a level that's competitive with what's being paid now. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Nybold. Any questions for Mr. Nybold? Michael Harrison, welcome to the committee. Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Michael Harrison. I'm the Executive Director of Judicial Common Sense, a group I started with two retired attorneys about 6 years ago.
Mr. Harrison, could you pull your microphone up?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
And we currently have 17 attorneys that make up our committee. Due to the A5 amendment, I had two concerns, which was Section 2 and Section 19 of the original bill, which I see has been deleted. So, therefore, I have no need to testify. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Any further discussion? Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Jim King from Minnesota Management and Budget. I wasn't expecting to testify today, but there were some concerns our department has with the effective dates, a couple provisions in the delete all amendment, and I wanted to get those on record.
Mr. King, could you speak just a little
sure.
louder for us? Thank you.
Can you hear me now?
I think so.
Yeah. Thank you.
To coin a phrase.
Right. As Mr. Kyer explained earlier, in the Randolph case, it was determined that indigent appellants were entitled to publicly paid for defense. In that particular case, the Supreme Court noted that the public defender was not allowed to provide those services, so that they ordered my department, Minnesota Management and Budget, to pay cost of a private attorney in that case, and they also indicated that they expected that the legislature would provide a longer-term solution for this issue. So basically what's occurred since the Randolph case, which came down last July, was that our department has received court orders. Sometimes we don't hear about them until a couple months after the fact, but court orders to pay attorney fees and misdemeanor appellate cases. We've got four cases so far. We don't have any expertise in arranging for these services for the appeals. And what we've done so far is we've arranged to use the general contingent account to pay attorney's fees. But we've gotten various information from folks in the Attorney General's office and the courts as far as how much to pay the attorneys. In fact, the previous speaker was talking about some of those issues. We know even less about that. So we're probably not a very efficient party to be doing this, especially over the longer term. We were expecting the legislation would probably resolve this as you've gotten Sections 9 and 14, probably having that effective for the next fiscal year or perhaps even sooner. So we were surprised to see the effective date of those provisions for January of next year. That would basically mean our department would be paying for these services on basically an ad hoc basis for nearly a year and a half. And we were concerned about the effective date on that. We would propose to make it effective much sooner, July 1st or even sooner than that. I just wanted to get those comments on record.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Turner, in recognizing the predicament that Mr. King is talking about, would you agree with his perspective on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, Mr. King and I talked about this before. They do have a problem. They've got $20,000 out of a general contingent account that doesn't exist for this. They don't have the expertise to contract for this. But I don't know why we have the effective date of next January. And I don't know if anyone can tell me why.
Mr. Kyer, do you have a suggestion?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, the original effective date of January 1st was to coincide with the county's fiscal year based on the original bill. And some of you saw that original bill as introduced. We did have more of a trade of services in the child protection area. And so that's why we ended up with a January 1st date. I think we certainly could talk about a different date. A couple of things that we've got going on right now, if in fact you go this route, we do have a backlog of a number of cases in the appellate office that we would obviously like to clear out before we take on anything else. And if you set a date of whatever date that's going to be that ends, You still are going to have those if these community notification hearing cases that are still going to linger. So we're going to end up somewhere, we're going to end up kind of with a dual system, if you will, because we're going to have some of those cases continue. To set the date out a little further gave us some opportunity to try to arrange some help to get rid of the backlog and to prepare for going forward on some of these changes in responsibilities. So that's the reason it's here.
And Mr. Chair, on that issue, we were ones that wanted, because our fiscal year obviously runs from year to year, and it's harder for us to raise that revenue. Part of the reason where we were contemplating early on, at least the original bill, is that we would pick up representation of the juveniles in straight-out CHIPS cases where they were not involved in any delinquency. That's no longer in the bill, so a lot of our motivation for having a later effective date probably is gone away for us. And so I think there's room for us to have an earlier effective date. It really comes down to Kevin's cash flow issues as opposed to really ours at this stage.
Mr. King, do you have a dollar amount of what that would represent for the remainder of this year?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, we've contracted out for approximately $20,000 worth of services. We've only paid a very small portion because we don't actually know the cost of these until they provide the appellant services. So it's rather hard for us to determine how much more we're going to have to pay out. We've only heard about four cases so far, but we expect there probably are others out there now that perhaps the word has not reached us. For some reason, the judges don't contact us directly, even if they mention our department by name in the order. So we find out about them 1 or 2 months later in general. So we don't... we've had some discussions with Mr. Kyer, and we think the annual cost of these may exceed $100,000 as soon as the right is generally well known in the community. But right now we're in the transition, and we've been trying to manage it prudently. But again, as I said, we don't have any expertise in this area, so the contracts we're attempting to enter into with these attorneys probably not the most efficient process. And probably not the cheapest process for the state to be engaged in now.
Mr. King, I think you have a legitimate concern. And do we have a date, Senator Tuma, that you might suggest? Did I say Senator Tuma?
you demoted me, Mr. Chair.
I am so sorry.
Mr. Demoted. Chair. I think... The normal July is fine by me, but again, it's not my issue so much, I think, as it is the Board of Public Defense, because I think the issue that was a big cost driver for us has been taken care of. So I don't want to suggest something without my partner in crime here giving his say.
Mr. Kyer?
Mr. Chairman and members, the only suggestion I could give to you all is typically you make these bills effective August 1st. And so that would give us at least a little more time to kind of figure out what we're going to do, number one, with our backlog, but also how this transition is going to take place. And, again, depending on whether or not this bill passes and when you all get out of here this spring, obviously those are factors in as well. So I think we could live with an August 1st date.
Mr. Kyer and Mr. Tuma, you've given me two different dates, July or August.
August 1st.
There's a consensus at the testifying table of August 1st. Mr. King, would that give you a little comfort to have an effective
Mr.
date?
Mr. Chairman, that's certainly better than January 1st of next year.
All right. Do I hear a motion to change the effective date? Senator Goodwin moves it on page... Mr. Backus will read the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll read the amendment, then I guess I have a question because there's three potential places to change it. I think you definitely want to change it on line 6.18 and then 10.11. You would delete January 1st, 2013, and insert August 1, 2012. The question I had, I guess, for the witnesses is whether you would want to consider changing it on 2.8, which is not that's where you have the right to counsel for the community notification people. Would you want to change it there as well, or just the other two places?
Mr. Chairman, I think to be consistent, I think if this is the way it's going to go, then yeah, we would like to be able to have it those effective dates the same, or at least the same, if not staggered 30 days, so we have some transition period, so that somebody's not doing one case one day and all of a sudden the next day they're picking up something else. So at a minimum, I guess we would say to have them the same date, but preferably at least a 30-day break there.
Mr. King, is your concern on all of these dates, or is there one or more that are just affecting your office?
Mr. Chairman, the last one we discussed is that particular issue doesn't affect our department, so we're open to whatever you choose on that. We're more concerned about the provisions relating to the Randolph case.
Mr. Kier, for the purpose of the uniformity, you suggested the date to go across in all instances. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's best.
All right. Mr. Turner, could you read Mr. Backus, could you read Senator Goodwin's amendment?
Mr. Chair, if the intent is to have all three dates be the same, then it would be on lines 2.8, 6.18, and 10.11. Delete January 1, 2013, and insert August 1, 2012.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Senator Goodwin renews her oral amendment as described by counsel. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Any other questions? Senator McGuire.
Mr. Chair, are you for the whole bill now? I want to renew my question from before. They've been pondering it. I'll just sort of review the question. I'm concerned that sometimes we have bills before us that are, you know, because we have funding situations that we're doing things. And I'm curious if this is a good start, or if this is a bill that is before us because we have funding situation. I mean, is this a good direction to be going in? It's just not far enough, or if you could comment on that,
Mr. Schuma.
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, I think it is a good start. These are concerns that our county officials have to make sure that we provide quality services. People that go into social services and in child protection matters don't do it because they have a vendetta against life. They really care about kids and care about what's going on, and so we've been working closely with those folks to make sure that we are fashioning a system that can ensure that individuals get placed as soon as possible who are in difficult situations. We think this legislation is a small but positive step in that direction, because I think it creates that peace in the valley, not to overuse that term. But right now we've been using a lot of our creative energy to fight over these issues, when we should be using a lot of our creative energy on how to work together to get those placements done in a cost-effective and in a reasonable manner. We think we can do it. Now, if you were to put together a bill, Senator McGuire, that talks about the criminal justice initiative that Chief Justice Blatz had a decade ago and wanted to resurrect that and wanted to have someone work with you to get that passed, I think Kevin and I would be right there with you trying to get better quality representation in there. But I think when you look at the overall nature of how we put this bill together, with the requirement that we have training for these individuals going into the courtroom, that we're looking for creative solutions that the county can participate in and manage their costs, not to just lower it for the lowest cost initiative, but really to provide quality services, I think you see our desire really is to make that positive step forward. And so when you put that bill together next year, Senator McGuire, we're going to be there with you.
Thank you. I'll definitely work on that. That sounds good. So then, could I hear from the Public Defender's Office on what
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Kier, is a good direction?
Senator McGuire, this is a step in the right direction.
Okay.
Is it ideal? No. I think Mr. Tuma in his opening remarks suggested that. I think that we've suggested that throughout the hearing. The ideal situation is Again, we would fund the Children's Justice Initiative that was put together back in the mid-90s. We came to this body or to the legislature several times to fund that with the support of the counties, with the support of the judicial branch and the prosecutors. That wasn't done. Ideal situation in some of these other instances would be to fund the misdemeanor appellate services. Senator Latz has a bill in the hopper. Representative Liebling has a bill in the hopper. But you all have a lot of needs, and you all have a lot of issues that you have to deal with on the fiscal side. So is this ideal? No, it isn't. But as Mr. Tuma indicated, I think it puts to bed a lot of issues that have gone and bothered a lot of us at this table and, frankly, around your table for close to 20 years. So it is a step in the right direction.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a bill that I might have even signed on to back when I was in the House, Mr. Chair. I have to look that up, see if I can resurrect it all. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none. Senator Hall renews his motion that Senate File 1678, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to Finance Committee.
Yes. Thank you.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
There is no further business before the committee. Adjourned.
I think it's nice. Yeah.